It's very exciting today to see the maturation over a number of years of green buildings and urbanism as presented at the Congress. It's worth mentioning to people in the audience that the CNU board has endorsed as preferred practice for its members the adoption of Ed Nasria's 2030 Architecture Challenge. If you're not familiar with that, it's a stepped increase in building energy performance between now and the year 2030 that asks that buildings be designed at increasing levels of energy efficiency. And so it is not simply casual talk that I talk about the integration of urbanism and green buildings. It's increasingly going to become, I think, the message of the CNU. So, which makes our session today and our three speakers' work and presentations ever more relevant. Our three speakers are Liana Kalakova, Chris Chizos, and Peter Pfeiffer. And I'm going to introduce them one at a time just before they speak. And there is an organization and structure to today's session. It will start at the scale of the larger neighborhood, the Miller Project here in Austin. The second speaker, Chris Chizos, will talk about both buildings and modifications to the block scale. And then our third speaker, Peter Pfeiffer, will talk principally about building scale interventions. Our first speaker, Dr. Liana Kalakova, got her PhD from Carnegie Mellon University in high-performance buildings and sustainability. She works for Austin Energy in the green building arena. She has consulted on the Mueller project here, the redevelopment of Austin's airport. She is on lead faculty, which puts her in a very elite club of people who get to teach the rest of the world on green building, and we look forward to her remarks on Mueller and her work there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have lights set up or down?
Go over there by the chairs.
Thank you and good morning. Well, it's great to have all of you here, and it's really an honor for Austin to host the CNU this year and to be able to have the opportunity to present you some of the Austin projects. So I would like to tell you the Miller story and explain to you how this development in which I'm involved for the last 5 years now is coming together. The Miller is the old airport for Austin. It actually went into operation in the 30s, and after many years, obviously the city grew, and it was deemed that the location as well as the size of the airport was not appropriate any longer for Austin, and especially the growth projections that went about for the city. So at that point, that was around the mid-80s. At that point, the city decided that there is a need to have the discussion about relocating the airport and went about trying to find a new location for that. The slide shows actually where the old airport was, and it was in a very, very close to downtown, less than 3 miles from downtown Austin, just 2 miles from the University of Texas, one of the larger employers here in town. So this is what the airport was deemed that had to move to another location. This is actually where we are now with this project, but I would like to take you through some of the things and how it came about. The city and the neighborhoods around the airport worked for years, actually more than a decade, to be able to figure out what is the best approach for this really large piece of land. It's about 711 acres. So they established first the goals. And some of these goals were they wanted to make this big area to produce a revenue stream for the city, to also bring jobs, new jobs to the city. But also they wanted to make sure that this was an opportunity to revitalize the East Austin area, which because of the airport being there had actually deteriorated over the years, was more disconnected from the rest of the city, and it was degrading rapidly. So that was a very vital goal from the beginning. They also wanted to improve the quality of life for the surrounding neighborhoods, have diversity in terms of housing options, in terms of the economical background of the people who will be locating there, and do all of that sustainably. And with that, they had high goals for both the buildings and the infrastructure and the neighborhood itself. I'll go through some of the milestones just briefly, just to show that this is a work in progress and it really took years to come. What I think it's really important to understand is this close connection between the city and the neighborhoods and that discussion, which actually is ongoing. It went on for many years. It's still going on. They have monthly meetings where the neighborhoods all around the old airport are contributing ideas, and they were a big part in shaping out the plan for Miller. So Roma actually was the group that helped the city come up with the plan. In 2000, the city adopted the plan, the redevelopment plan that Roma produced. In 2002, a developer was identified, and that was Catalas. And the master development agreement got into place in 2004. Last year, in 2007, the first big milestones happened for this area. One of the anchor developments, the Dell Children's Medical Center of Central Texas, opened in June of 2007. And later in the year, in the very last part, November and December, the first residents moved in. So what does it mean? What are the numbers for this development? As I said, it's a 711 acres development, and it is an industrial brownfield. The city actually had to take action on that and provide the remediation and rehabilitation of that whole site. Commercial square footage, 4.2 million square feet. And you can see the breakdown between office, medical, retail, and film production, which since we are in Austin, this is really part of the fabric of the city. Residential units, about 4,600 of them, about 10,000 new residents are expected to move into the Miller redevelopment, and there is a good breakdown between yard houses and row houses. And the important thing in this part is that 25% of these homes will be affordable housing, will go to people that have much lower than the median family income in Austin. Another big goal from the beginning was to preserve open space, and more than 20% actually of the area is dedicated to open space. So let's start with what are the major components of this plan. And I will start with the 140 acres of open space that are all around Miller development. It's an interconnected system. They're actually designed so that the surrounding neighborhoods will be able to interact well with the new Miller neighborhood. And actually, it has more than 5 miles of hike and bike trails that are going all around the plan. Streets and transportation. From the beginning, the plan was for this to be a pedestrian-friendly community, a community that will reduce the dependence on automobile and will encourage the use of bikes and pedestrian going through the neighborhood. So the streets actually are designed to accomplish that. Moreover, there is plan, and actually that is already funded, for a light rail system and a rapid bus system. The neighborhoods, as I mentioned, there is a variety of homes that have been planned for this. Yard houses, there are specific guidelines that were developed for Miller. All the homes have to have porches on the front and garages on the back through alleys. Miller houses are a specific type of development that will be part of the character of Miller. The town center was supposed and is bringing new businesses and new employers, or old employers that are relocating within Miller. I have identified some of the major employers. Seaton actually is moving the headquarters besides the hospital at Miller. UT is building the Dell Pediatric Research Institute. So these are really all very exciting opportunities for the area. But what are the sustainable urbanism initiatives that we're taking here? The Roma plan actually identified three big areas of contribution here. And one is to have a green community design. Green buildings is a big part, and green infrastructure. So let's go through those. Green community design. We discussed about this brownfield that now is going to be a vital part of the Austin community. It's going to be pedestrian friendly. It has the commuter rail and the rapid bus that is going to serve. Retail and jobs are going to be nearby the residences, so people won't have to get into the car to go shop. And the streets have double lines of trees that actually make them quite comfortable. This is the Texas climate, so in the summer, the shade and the protection is really appreciated. Green buildings. From the beginning, the city made the goal to have all of the structures at Miller being green. All of the commercial projects need to achieve either a 2-star Austin Energy Green Building rating or at a minimum be LEED certified. All of the residential buildings at Miller need to achieve at a minimum a 3-star green building rating. I'll mention just for a couple of minutes, for those of you who are not familiar, who are not living in Austin and are not familiar with the Austin Energy Green Building, a few words about our program. It was the first green building program in the U.S. It was established in 1991, and the first group to develop a system to rate the sustainability of buildings. I find it always interesting that the first goal is to delay the need for new power plants. Austin Energy, I believe, is a very progressive utility, and they had a goal from the beginning that it is much more efficient to use their existing plants productively rather than building new plants. So by shaving the peak demand, they could delay the need for new power plants. And actually, that has been the case since the mid-80s. And the city has really grown tremendously since then. So these are some of the results and our contribution within the city. 7,500 homes are rated so far. Our rating is based on stars, 1 to 5 stars, 5 being the highest, and only 50 of them so far have achieved the 5-star rating. The commercial program has rated about 2.5 million square feet so far, but as you can see, green building has really taken off in Austin, and 135 projects are now working with us toward a green building rating. Our rating is very similar to LEED, Austin Energy Green Building has actually a long history with USGBC. We have been one of the founding members, and our staff has participated actively in the development of LEED. So the ratings are quite similar. So if a project wants to go for one rating and achieve the other at the same time, that will be done with not much additional effort. Our rating is specifically geared to this climatic, to the climatic conditions and the regional peculiarities of Austin. So it is more relevant, however, very similar to LEED as well. So how are the buildings doing at Miller so far? Some of them actually have already achieved LEED ratings or green building ratings, and there are only a handful of them that are completed so far. The Miller Center, which is the visitor center, the center where it's welcoming the people who are visiting the development and also houses the Catella's offices, has achieved an Austin Energy Green Building 4-star rating and a LEED Gold. Several other projects have been completed already, and they will be soon rated. There are other projects that are in construction, but what I would like to point out is what are these projects achieving in terms of performance in green building. At least 15% energy savings, at least 15% water use reduction. They're diverting more than 50% of the construction waste from the landfill. They all have cool roofs. They all have low-emitting materials, especially in terms of paints and coatings, and they all have native landscaping. There are many other initiatives that are going on here, but due to not having enough time, I will not go into detail. These are some of the major achievements for Miller Central, the visitor center, and you can see 77% water use reduction. Water actually is a huge issue in Texas, and droughts, we seem to be always within a drought period. And how about some of the homes? So the first neighborhood consisted of 330 homes. As of March 2008, as of last month, 112 homes have been completed and rated, 98 of them 3-star, and as you can see, 6 in the 4-star and 8 in the 5-star range. Actually, one of the builders has committed to only build 5-star homes at Miller. And generally, what we see by working with them is that we feel quite comfortable that every single project will be able to achieve and surpass the requirements that the city set at the onset. But the last major component of this effort has to do with the green infrastructure, and it has many phases here. The first one will be the parks, and as you can understand, the impact that these parks are playing, they are at the outskirts of the development, and they are not just green spaces, they are also serving another very important role for stormwater management. In one of the photographs shows the Central Park in Austin, which was an earlier project that had achieved quite exceptional results in terms of stormwater management. Trees. That's, we are in Texas. And this was a site that really didn't have any. So 15,000 trees are going to be planted over this period. Actually, one interesting story, and that's what these photographs show, is from, there was a development in Bastrop where they had several trees, and the developer was planning to remove them. Well, Catella's made a commitment to transplant those. They had them transferred and planted next to the tower, and now slowly are replanting them in several areas within the neighborhoods. We talked about the pedestrian and the pedestrian-friendly and the bicycle options that they're getting within the development. The reclaimed water is another city effort. Actually, the Water Conservation Department of the City of Austin is actively participating in that. There's going to be a tank that will hold more than 2 million gallons of water, and this water will serve to will provide water for irrigation and industrial uses to most of the buildings within Miller. I'll spend just 2 or 3 minutes to talk about a combined heat and power plant. This is an effort that was between the city, Austin Energy, and Catalas and the Seton Hospital. Why I think that is important, and it's because there are many benefits for having such an effort and such a district approach within the development. But I would like to point out the fact that the usual delivery, what we have is when we have the power plant, when we have one BTU in, only about 30% of that energy that goes in will reach the end user. The rest is actually lost. It's lost during production, it's lost during transmission. However, if we do have a combined heat and power plant close by in the community, you have 70% more efficient way of delivering the energy to the end user. As you can see here, from one BTU that goes in, 0.7 gets to the end user. That has tremendous implications in terms of pollution, and obviously that is of great importance to Austin. You can see what are the reductions in terms of carbon dioxide and what they're calling the SOx and NOx, and that is compared actually in this slide to the Austin Energy's mix of fuels. If you compare it to the typical coal plant, the numbers are really way more impressive. But there are many benefits for the owner as well. The owner that is considering such an approach, like the Seton Hospital, they were able to save upfront costs, $7 million, because they didn't have to worry about the cooling towers or the boilers, and they still had a very reliable energy within their site. So, and environmental benefits as well. This combined heat and power plant is designed to serve the entire development. And because the emissions are going to be reduced that much, the Austin Energy Engineers and our group worked with USGBC and LEED to justify for those projects that they are achieving efficiencies way above and beyond a regular project will achieve. That's how actually the hospital will be able to go for a very high rating, and we hope that will be platinum. I just wanted to summarize the highlights of this development and mention that the project Miller has been accepted as a pilot participant in the LEED for Neighborhood Developments, and we are really glad to be part of this. The way that USGBC works, during the pilot phase, the projects that participate actually are able to influence the development of the final rating tool. And that is a tremendous opportunity for us and a tremendous opportunity, I think, for everybody participating. So thank you. And that's my... Thank you.
Thank you, Liana. Wonderful presentation. Wonderful. And we're delighted to have Miller in the LEED ND pilot program. Our next speaker, Chris Chizos, works with Vicinia Development. I think he's going to talk to us today about the 969 land development. He's also been involved and is involved in a couple of other notable projects we may hear about, too. A sustainable development called Agave, and then a project called Fiore, which has achieved the 5-star.
Will be applying for.
I've jumped the gun. Will be applying for. There's a difference between achieving and applying for. But we appreciate your intentions. Applying for the 5-star status in the Austin Green Builder Program. Chris.
Good morning, everybody. Let me get this set up real quick. As Doug said, I work for Vicinia Development, which is a company that was created to develop and build an existing neighborhood on the east side of Austin. It's actually comprised of several different model types within the neighborhood. And in the spirit of sort of larger scale to smaller scale, I'll talk a little bit about the overall 969 development, which includes Agave in two different manifestations, a more traditional villas, and then this new five-star program that we're going to be applying for, which we're calling Fiore. I want to also give credit and thanks to the people that were involved. I am the architectural planning director, but the designers were Casabella Architects, particularly for the Fiore project, and TBG is doing a lot of the landscaping and more of the urban planning stuff, so I wanted to thank them both. We are located, and maybe I can point this out, on the east side of Austin, which is about 6 miles from downtown. It runs straight out MLK or 969 Highway. Don't know if I'm going to be able to use this right here. And it's actually right on the route for one of the proposed light rail systems, which will be the Mainer line. Pending approval from the city, this will actually happen in the next 2 to 3 years. So we're within walking distance of a proposed stop on the Mainer line of the light rail. This was an existing subdivision. It was already planned out and plotted when we moved in. It's 225 acres, and there's just over 900 lots. The gray area that you see was primarily developed when the primarily already built out when the developer acquired the land. It was a combination of both a trailer park and when they decommissioned the Bergstrom Airport, they brought homes over from there that were actually military homes and installed them as low-income or affordable housing on the site. So when the developer came in, the site actually had about 300 homes that were already on the site. So we came in and started looking at how we could both separate ourselves from just the traditional housing and look for different opportunities for different markets. As you see, this is a breakdown of the different products that we have. The orange is the Agave project, and many of you in Austin have probably already heard or maybe seen some of that that's gone on. It is we're applying for a three-star with all the homes in Agave. It is primarily design-based, so we've asked 10 different architects, local architects in the Austin area, to design for us. It's modern then we have the blue, which you see is the villas. The villas are a more traditional kind of Mediterranean style home, and we used it to some extent as kind of a buffer or a little easing between the very traditional housing and the newer housing that we were putting in. There was also the issue of price. We were trying to have some more affordable housing that we were developing, and those range in the 150s to low 200s. The brown section that you see that actually wraps around this is a new product that we're just starting. We just started putting foundations on the ground, and that is actually going to be what we're calling Agave Design Series. It's a little bit more affordable version of the original Agave. When we started, the pricing for Agave was in the low 200s to 300s, and the price went up significantly, both from just value of land going up, but also we were adding amenities and adding more green building aspects that we had to price in. So we've gone back and had our architects design some lower cost or more affordable version of it. So they'll be in the 190s to 250 range. And then primarily what I want to talk about today is the dark green section here, which is Fiore. We've actually got the permitting for all the Fiore or the initial houses for Fiore, and I want to take you through some of what we've done on the planning side to really relook at what neighborhood can be and how the houses work with green spaces. Let's see. The green spaces that you see, there's two green spaces at the front as you come in that are both in floodplain. This larger section at the bottom is all in floodplain, so we can't develop. And then we've added some pocket parks, and those will be supplemented as well as we go through development. We are in a we're working together right now with the Austin Green Art Association. We just started a relationship with them, and they're a nonprofit here in Austin that's a group of artists that come in and they do collective work. And one of the big issues with us is that because we have homes of different income levels and different cultures within one subdivision, we wanted to not only create public spaces that bring people together, that start to talk about how they can do stuff, but actually that they could help implement. So they're experts at bringing in different communities and actually having them volunteer to build some of the projects. They do like rotating art exhibits, and they're going to be actually doing all our green spaces. And then we'll have a larger walking or biking track that goes all the way around and connects in. Quickly, these are some of the agave homes that are existing right now. It's about 160 original lots with some room to expand. We have about 70 on the ground right now, just to give you an idea of what agave looked like. This is just some early renderings for some of the agave design series, which are in the same vein. But I want to really get into Fiore right now. The guiding principle is to really increase the sense of community created by looking at more of a master plan. When we started with agave, it was traditional lots. We were just building houses, and we hadn't really looked at an overall plan. We also wanted to look at the distinctive style and have a more unified design. So we actually asked Casabella, a single architect, to design the whole development within that area, which is about 200 homes. And we wanted to increase the green rating. So we're actually applying for a 5-star green rating on all of our houses. The concepts behind it was the pairing of homes to promote courtyards and more semi-private and sort of shared spaces. We also wanted to minimize the impact of the car. There are existing, and I'll show you some pictures, but there are existing alleyways. We can actually maybe back up for a second. If you see the green spaces here in the darker section, those were actually paved alleyways that were running through the development. And so we wanted to take those out and actually make them green park spaces and have the cars actually work on the street primarily. Also the open spaces and really look at the indoor-outdoor and the potential for activities and sustainable features as more common spaces. The different precedents that they looked at were both the European and Central America villas and farmhouses. They also looked at some international style modernist movement houses and Los Angeles courtyard houses, as well as the Eichler homes in California, and also the Houston's Memorial Bend, if any of you are familiar with that. I will quickly go through. These are some of the examples of the villages and farmhouses, the modernist movement houses that were precedent, and the courtyard houses and the Memorial Bend houses. So what they drew from these different precedents was really an emphasis on the indoor-outdoor living and the simple house forms. So looking at that combined with trends of downsizing, master plan communities, flexible floor plans, sustainable design within our local client, climate, indoor-outdoor interaction, increased density, garden homes, loft condominiums, and mixed-use walkable spaces. This is just showing the idea that a traditional post-World War II residence is single-family lots sort of spaced out evenly, and that there is potential for actually reorganizing that a little bit. As I said, the lots were already defined, so we had to work within that parameter. The site study, quickly, just we have great views of downtown, so we wanted to capture that. We also we're looking at the idea of roof gardens as a possibility for both reducing solar gain on the house, but also capturing some of these views, and maybe even communal spaces where we could get some of this. Also, the idea of pedestrian friendly, so that we have a large group of homes in one area that's actually walkable, and we wanted to make sure that people could interact and get to those different areas without having to walk through yards. The water collection and filtration, because it was existing and we were actually taking out what ended up being a paved drainage easement, we had to reaccount for all the drainage, so there was a significant amount of work on that. The community spaces, as we're working with Austin Green Art, we're also looking at the idea of sort of a phased development. So as we develop these homes, we will, as the HOA gets bigger and more people are coming in, they'll have a lot of say in how programmatically some of these common spaces happen. But initially, we were looking at the ideas of community, an additional community garden, which we already have in an agave, even the idea of small market spaces that people could come in and set up, you know, local, there's several down the road, local farmers that have little green stands that they could come and set up, play facilities. And so we started with the idea of the courtyard scheme and layered setback scheme, which is that we, as I said, we took these, this is an initial sort of sketch, and also the idea of the setback, so that as we start to set back, that we could pull back at different layers, both, you know, on different levels of the house, where you could have public spaces or private spaces that address both the park and the street. The prototype family, this is a development where they have more of a courtyard example, both the garage and courtyard, so the cars actually pull off the street. What we wanted to do was actually have this central park and kind of flip what traditionally would have been the car going through the alley and being hid, and really emphasize the middle alley park. This is Houston's Fourth Ward, which is very close to some of the existing alleys that we have, which are also drainage easements in the traditional homes. And if you take some of the stuff out and start to look at making it a greener space, it actually becomes something that people can interact in and walk around. These are a courtyard layout, which actually does provide some private, some semi-public, and some public space. And looking at whether they're attached or detached with the alley park, but you only get a 10-foot minimum separation between homes if you have a 5-foot setback. What we propose is, because this is SF4, which is a building type here in Austin that really allows zero-lot setbacks, we were able to take some of the houses and actually put them together so that we could increase that middle section and really open up some of the green spaces and bring some of the more public spaces into the actual lots. Also, the idea of layered setback, as I said, with different layers of public space. I'm going to go through a little bit. Here are some of the diagrams of the actual the plan as it is. The constraints that we had to deal with were the park that I had mentioned and the easement. We're starting to put in some of the ornamental landscape, all natural or all local varieties, working with the Austin Green Building Program on that. This is, again, the drainage that we talked to, and the pedestrian, as they come through the community, the pedestrian walkway, where you actually end up with nodes of interaction. And those nodes, some will be developed originally, and then others will be kind of left open to HOA and the existing homeowners determining. As we went through the looking at the actual landscape design, this is the most current version of the park as it exists for the first 23 homes. And so this will be started in the next month or so. But this is the park running through, with the houses front-loaded with parking, communal spaces that have gardens, lawns, gathering spots. And as on a bigger scale, the red section that is on the right-hand side is what we were just looking at. We will have connecting parts through the whole development so that people can actually access it through. It's a little bit of a topographical challenge because there's significant slopes. And just to show you a little bit, these are some of the cross-sections going through with how this garden space relates to the different houses. There's been some stuff that we've done with actually using foundation as retaining wall to maximize that park space, and also to give a little bit of privacy by using different elevations. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. I think the urbanists in the audience will have some pointed questions for your urbanism. Our third final speaker, Peter Pfeiffer, FAIA, is a founding principal of Barley and Pfeiffer Architects, who work really around North America on more than 600 projects with an emphasis on sustainability. He is a LEED accredited professional, an architect and building scientist, let's just hear from Peter. Peter.
I was going to say, that's good enough. So you've all seen stuff regarding the urbanist point of view. And I often am stuck with this thing of, what do you do when people say, you know, what is green building? When I've got clients who come up to me or the person on the street and say, what is green building? I found that if there's one thing I've learned, it's that don't ever underestimate the value of stating the obvious. And when it comes to green building, what that means, I think, is, Chris, just a second here, is a whole idea of green by design. Make some smart choices right from the start. To me, green building is not about the solar collectors on the roof. As a matter of fact, when we look at the early green movement from the 70s, we saw a lot of mistakes when we really got into the solar stuff. I don't know if you can see this house, Doug, but it's a house we were called to consult that was built in the 70s here in Austin that's got all this solar heating capacity to poor people have to air condition the home in the wintertime. So we don't want to do that type of stuff again. And we do want to recognize that people do want to live well. Yes, it would be nice if I sold off a few of my kids and then could live in a 2,000-square-foot home with my yuppie wife. But, you know, I've got 4 kids, and I'm not going to sell any of them. And there are people out there with kids who want to live green. So we are going to be building some slightly bigger homes, at least for the time being. But it's okay. It's a little bit maybe better if that house consumes less energy than a 1,000-square-foot condominium, which this one does. So I call that luxury living with less guilt. And I also, when I'm explaining this green building to people, I explain to them that there's going to be contradictions and compromises. You might do some things to save energy that might mean you're using some materials that we're not sure about their off-gassing of. But I want to put that in perspective. Let's talk about indoor air quality for a second. We all get wrapped up in volatile organic compounds. Well, if you smoke cigarettes, give me a break. Or if you clean your cabinets with Formula 409, give me a break. What are we worried about the VOCs coming out of the carpet from? Or if you sleep with your car by having your garage attached to your house, give me a break. So I try to encourage people not to get wrapped up in the minutia and try to look at the bigger picture of what green building is, which to me it just boils down to these 3 things. It's reduced consumption and it's improved health, and then reducing your environmental impact. That's it. You know, you'll hear all these lofty definitions by our friends at the AIA or even the U.S. Green Building Council, but this is all it is, folks. It's just those 3 things. That reduced consumption thing has a very large component called energy conservation, which Liana spoke about. And by the way, one of the neat things about the Austin Energy Program is, you know those Energy Star light bulbs and appliances you buy? That started in Austin in the 80s, in the early 80s, as the conservation power plant idea. We called it the Austin Energy Star. And we found over 24 years it was cheaper to incent people to save energy, to pay them more money to buy a more efficient air conditioner, than it was to build that new power plant that Liana was talking about. So here we are 24 years later, and we never did have to build that new power plant. But the nifty thing for you to know is that Federal Energy Star program started as the Austin Energy Star program. This is where it all started. It was kind of nifty. But energy conservation is big because it also reduces air pollution. And then there's water and materials conservation. But those 3 things, in my view, is what green building is. And as I see this second green building movement in my lifetime getting legs, I fear that we're making some of the same mistakes that were made during that early green building movement where I showed you that solar house in the 70s, where we're doing some pretty ridiculous things and trying to tell people it's green. Now, this is a good idea of a vitamin-enriched cigarette. Now, there's one of the guys in the audience here. David, why don't you stand up? David used to smoke these vitamin-enriched cigarettes, and he's here to tell you that they don't work very well. You know, if you inject vitamin C in a cigarette and you smoke it, you're not really doing yourself any good. And just like if you put a patch of solar collectors on the roof and a patch of grass on the roof, but you look at the building and you say, but it's not a very sustainable building. Why not? There are no overhangs. There's no solar shading. So what that means is the energy consumption associated with the lack of solar shading will be 5 times worse than those solar panels will ever produce for you. And the amount of work associated with maintaining this building and the caulks and the finishes that will be needed because it has no overhangs is absurdly high. So this would be a green building if it's in a climate where there's no rain or sun or heat or cold. It would be pretty well. So you got to be a bit of a cynic when you look at these things. And you want to look at what is wrong with the basics of this building. The basics of the building weren't there. It wasn't designed and laid out to respond to the climate, and it can't sustain itself. So just because it's got solar collectors or it's got a patch of grass on the roof doesn't mean it's a green building. And really, the green building comes in the design process, the very beginning of the design process. It's when you sit down with a client and you ask them why they do want to build that 5,000 square foot empty nester's cottage. That's when you have the ability to really influence. And I'm saying this stuff because I think many of you are architects and builders, architects and planners in the group. And one of the things I've realized that we should be doing as those is using our articulative skills to tell people what green building is and make them or help them make smarter decisions when they're thinking about building their home. So we talk about the layout and the fact that, you know, a two-story home is going to be inherently less energy consuming than a one-story home. And the fact that the color of your roof and the pitch of the roof will have a lot to do with your energy consumption and your comfort. And that a dark-colored exterior color scheme is going to consume more energy and require more maintenance than a light-colored exterior color scheme. So that's why those are just some examples of what I was saying earlier. Don't underestimate the value of stating the very obvious. It's probably obvious to all of you that light colors absorb less heat, but it isn't necessarily to most people. And some of the other things we talk about, especially if they want to do a house out in the suburbs or the hill country, is we say, well, what's going to happen when gas gets to $8 a gallon? I'm pretty proud of the fact in the past few years we've actually torpedoed about a half a dozen of our own projects that way. And it's true that we did. These folks, one couple called up and said, you know, we're selling our lot, our property out in the hill country. We're going to look for something in town. You said something at a meeting 2 years ago, and I'm sorry, we're going to be stopping our project for the time being, but don't worry, we'll be doing something with you. But it really sunk in what you said. I think that's part of our role, too. And then here's another very obvious thing. They got it about 25% correct, or maybe 50% correct at Mueller Airport, which I suppose isn't bad. Orientation of the streets. Running your streets east-west is the single most effective thing you can do to reduce energy consumption in most of North America. I want you to hear that again. Running your streets east-west is the single most effective thing you can do to reduce energy consumption in North America. Now, I hope you all know why. So that your houses can get good solar access and you minimize your west-facing windows and your east-facing windows. Very basic thing. And as I say, at the Catullus Group, I don't know who planned Mueller Airport, but do you? You guys got it about 25% to 50% right, I saw. And it's really sad because you're doing these row homes and the fronts all face west, and you got to have some windows. But by God, west is really a lousy orientation in a lot of America. So then this, I'll just talk briefly about this. This whole price per square foot mindset is another thing we talk to folks about. Get over it. There is a better way of evaluating the value of what we do than judging how much it costs per square foot. You see, that's David when he was younger scratching his head trying to figure out how to measure his square foot. We also talked to him about ceiling heights and the effect that they're going to have on energy consumption. The more air in the house, the more air you have to condition. Or your choice of roof. Those red spots are from an ultraviolet photograph showing the hot spots in that neighborhood, contributing 5 to 7 degrees to the urban heat island effect. So basic things like dark roofs aren't very smart to do in much of North America. They make your neighborhoods hotter. The roof is a shading umbrella, and we want to learn how to deal with the heat. We really do have a lot of fun with shading devices. And you'll see the question that always comes up is, won't that make my home dark? These don't. You get nice reflected light. That's that same home. So to me, what passive solar design now in the new millennium is knowing how to deal with the heat, not so much how to collect the heat. And again, we do work all over the United States, and I want you to understand that even in Kansas City, Missouri, or Chicago, Illinois, this is very important. And the difference is, or the reason why, is because people air condition much more than they did when we were kids. I bet you if I had you raise your hands, most of you who are 45 and older grew up in a home without central air conditioning, and most all of you live in a home with central air conditioning now. And that has really had a profound effect on the way we should build. That's finally beginning to sink into the building codes and into the building industry. But suffice it to say, if you don't build a house to respond to air conditioning in Chicago, you could make your occupants sick. And people in Kansas City, Missouri, air condition their home more months a year than they heat their home. So who would have thought of Kansas City, Missouri as being an air conditioning or a southern climate zone? But it is. So we have to know how to deal with the heat. And one of the ways we're doing that with some of our projects now here, and I'm going to show you two examples, is this infill condominium project near the UT campus. It was formerly just 350 by 135-foot lots that we're now putting this 18-unit condominium complex on. You'll notice something. Basically, light-colored exteriors where we can, large overhangs, and there are even more at the windows, but light-colored interiors make it so we get a lot more reflected light in there, reducing the need for electric lighting. So we had lousy orientation with that building, but we did a lot to shade the windows anyway. The other project is... Well, it's at a large urban infill site that I can't mention. But it's very small lots that were 55 by 110, and we were looking at what do we do with this new urbanist single-family home there. Well, the first thing we do is make sure we're very orientation-specific with the way we designed our windows. Thankfully, we got a lot that faced southwest, south-southwest, so we were able to do a lot of shading diagrams to make sure we got good shading on these windows and minimize the stuff that's really facing west, and where there is, really put quite a bit into the solar shading. But there are some other fun things that we did that ties into what Chris said. We looked at the alleys as being a nifty place, not just a utilitarian place. And in this subdivision, or in this neighborhood, the alleys are going to be open where the garages open up to. So we looked at this idea of doing a garage port, which is a garage and carport, the carport side being open to the backyard and to the prevailing breezes, so that it's a covered play area when you don't have a car in there. And it's facing to the breezes, and it could make this neat play area off the alley, and that's a screened-in porch. So you actually get people who might interact with other people in the neighborhood and take in the breezes. And one of the other nifty things about doing this is when you detach the garage from the house, that's the single most beneficial thing you can do to improve indoor air quality. Don't sleep with your Suburban or your hybrid or whatever. Keep all those poisonous things that are normally in a garage, fertilizer, insecticide, totally removed from the indoor air of your home. So we can integrate that stuff into these small, tight designs too. There's a screened-in porch, by the way. The breezes come from this direction. It's no coincidence that the stairs are on the opposite side from where the breezes come from, so each and every house has a thermal siphon, so you can have enhanced natural ventilation and give people a fighting chance of living comfortably without air conditioning during a lot of the year. I think you got about a minute or two left?
Three.
Let's wrap up with this little interconnectivity thing because it's kind of fun. I love this building science aspect of architecture. We look at the whole idea of insulation, and people are all wrapped up in R values, and the code officials get good steak dinners from the manufacturers of insulation, so they think that you do need to have lots of R value in walls. And I'm sorry about my cynicism, but I've been to code hearings. Consider the styrofoam cup, and you'll realize that an R1 cup can allow you to hold 150-degree water against your hand, and you'll realize there's a lot more to thermal performance than worrying about R value. It's stopping vapor and humidity flow, which is why we've gone entirely over the past 10 years into the sealed attic concept to keep vapor and humidity out of your house, because if it comes in your attic, it's going to come down into your house, and then if your air conditioning ducts are in the attic, that's bad. And then if those ducts leak, your house sucks, which makes the whole thing even worse because it's sucking in outside air. So little simple things like a sealed attic really does a lot to improve your indoor air quality and reduce humidity issues. But the other thing it does, you see, is if you don't have leaky ducts to the outside, then your house doesn't suck. And if your house were to suck and you're sleeping with your car and you happen to have the Grim Reaper in your garage, you're sucking him right into your house. So you see the interconnection between air conditioning ducts and garage placement to your health. We want to make sure air is coming from places we know where it should be coming from. And then maybe a last point is when we encourage people about lighting, for every 75-watt light bulb you replace with an 18-watt fluorescent, we're saving a quarter of a ton of coal from being burnt at our local power plant, or in other areas that might be a barrel of oil. That's just with one light bulb replacement. That's why we push so much on, first and foremost, daylighting and light-colored finishes. That saves a tremendous amount of energy. Lighting is your second cause of energy consumption in most of these custom homes. And then we do use primarily fluorescents. Almost every light in that photograph is a fluorescent light. But you see the daylighting coming down from the stair tower. There's 300 watts burning in that kitchen instead of the typical 1,500 to 2,000. So that's a nice little wrap to make the point of zooming down from where you started, Liana, on the big picture, then Chris went down to his, and I just zoomed it down a little bit more to this whole idea of energy conservation and using your good common sense to do green building. Energy conservation is a low-hanging fruit. Those decisions that are made during programming design are the ones that have the greatest effect towards that. And probably the biggest point is that those of you in the audience who are realtors, architects, planners, builders, you have a position to articulate the value of green planning to your clients so we can all do better green building. Thanks a lot.
I want to thank our three presenters for concise, on-point, fruitful presentations that I think will seed a very good Q&A. So we've got 15 minutes, 15 whole minutes. So you've had questions you've been dying to ask. Why don't you stand up, tell us who you are, and pose your question.
If I think I understood the question, you asked if there was any notion to the idea of dirty power and the effect of fluorescent light bulbs in a house. When you say that, you mean the mercury in fluorescent light bulbs? Is that your concern?
I don't know the details
of it. What's your question then? I think you might be referring to electromagnetic forces that are put out when you've got a lot of... Well, there is a notion behind that. It's probably a little bit more than just a notion. But what we try to do is... I think if it's what you're referring to, is you refer to the negative health effects of EMFs. Basic common sense things is the further you are from a source of electricity, it drops, its effect drops off as a square of the distance. So if you're 2 feet away from something, it's one quarter as strong. If you're 8 feet away from that source of electricity, it's 1/64 as strong. So using that basic bit of information, when we are designing our homes, we ask the electricians never to run wires along the bed wall. If there is a wall where the bed is going to go in your bedroom, we make sure the wires go up, over, and back down instead of just from one outlet to the next. And we never put an electrical panel in a bedroom or near a place where somebody is going to be spending a lot of time. So that's our basic approach to it. But do you have any knowledge about it? I thought what you were going to say, and I want to say this, is because this will come up by somebody anyway, is folks ask me about the mercury content of fluorescents, because I really do believe the new fluorescents are worth getting to know. They're almost new. They're new ones coming out every month. The amount of energy that's saved because of fluorescents is phenomenal, and therefore there is a whole lot less mercury ever put into the atmosphere because we're not burning the coal that also contains mercury. So the little bit of mercury in fluorescence is nothing compared to the amount of mercury it's saved from being spewed into the environment at that coal-fired power plant. Would you agree with that?
Totally. Yeah.
Totally.
I was going to say, we've already turned a session on urbanism and green buildings into discussing light bulbs. And so we're off track. We need to get on track. Next question.
No. It was predicated on the assumption that even with shotgun sights, people have more windows in the front of their house and the back of the house than they do on the sides. That's what it, the whole point is, get most of your windows facing north and south and minimize your windows facing west especially. That's really the point.
Sir.
Oh, darn. I was hoping somebody else would get that one. I don't know. I think educating the public. I think this. That's why I started off with that cynical thing about that vitamin-enriched cigarette house at West Coast Green last year. I'm tired of seeing these demonstration green projects with a patch of green grass on the roof and calling it green. I think just educate your customers and the public about smart planning and smart design decisions and the value of them. That's my approach, at least.
I would say that the Austin Green Building Program is really good. The Austin Green Building Program is really good. They're obviously performance-based because their intention is to save power use, but they're very good at the way they balance their rating system across materials, orientation, and a lot of that. And so even getting in contact with them or as you go through the rating process, there's a lot of information you can garner, and they will work with you and suggest alternative materials. We've been working with them for a couple of years, and it's a great resource.
I'm going to pose the next question because nobody seems to be asking the question I want you all to ask.
He's been dying to have you ask this question.
Yeah, come on. I've been sending telepathy, and it just hasn't been going through. I want to direct this to Chris. The question was about greenwashing. This is a conference devoted large part to urbanism. There's neighborhood washing, because I think your project, though it was called a neighborhood, is not by urbanist definition a neighborhood. It lacks civic uses. The streets don't connect. The blocks are too long. It's walkable, meaning there are facilities to walk, but there's nowhere to walk to. It's about the right size to be a neighborhood, but it's not a neighborhood. What do you say?
Well, this will probably be my excuse for a lot of things, but we did come into it with it already laid out. So that was an issue right there. We have set aside a small portion as you enter in that we have been able to get a commercial zoning for, so that we're going to be doing it's not mixed use in that it's residential and commercial, but it's mixed use in that it's some retail space and some office space. So that'll be about 12,000 to 16,000 square foot, and we already have interested clients in using that office, or existing homeowners using that office and retail space. As we push out into emerging, different sectors of the community, it's not all developed. So what we're trying to do is work with local, the Center for Maximum Potential with Plenty Fisk is sort of conceiving this East Austin Green corridor, where he's encouraging different green-centered businesses and stuff to come into this area. So we're actually working in tandem with him now. Because it, like I said, it was already developed, there's not as much opportunity within that. But some of the ideas we came up with, like the Mercado within the Fiore development, like having a space where on Saturdays and Sundays local farmers can come and sell, products, and trying to consolidate some of the recycling centers and the the mail collection centers, so that people are encouraged to walk through this park and interact with each other. That's how we address it within the constraint of having an already laid out subdivision.
Right. Sir.
All the lots were actually already designed when the developer purchased. Yes. There is some green space, and like I said, some of that is, or very little of that is actually buildable because a lot of it's in the flood zone. We are working with Austin Green Art that I talked about earlier and TBG to look into the idea of turning it over to some preserve, to doing some wetland preserve and some resource preserve space. So we are redeveloping that a little bit, but as far as commercial space, other than the small area that we have at the front, there isn't really opportunity.
You've had your hand up, yeah.
Sarah Wood from Mount Road. It's Dago from Florida.
No, I think in fact, hopefully it will do the opposite. What we found is that in the existing homes, it's a little different because some of our lots have this middle alley section and some don't. The new Agave project that we had started did not, so it wasn't a condition we had to deal with. When we looked at these group of lots that we were going to develop, and we looked at the existing homes that were there, the alleys had become, what you ended up with is a street that was basically for the cars and an alley that was for the cars, because people would both park on the street, drive through the alley, and park in the alley. So we were sort of losing both spaces to the cars. And so what we tried to look at is to say, can we keep the cars in the street, because, you know, we don't have the opportunity to intervene too much into that space. And then what we've called internally sort of the green street is what we're hoping is that becomes the new street front in the old tradition of walking around and talking to neighbors. We've even talked about the idea of you know, you have your address, but maybe there's a separate name for each house so that people, you know, they get to know their neighbor by walking through this area. So because we had both the alley and the street basically taken over by cars, we tried to take some of that back to the more, you know, a more urban, a more walkable area.
Of course, I think we'd like you to stick around for the next 3 days and hang out at the Congress and learn about urbanism. gentlemen in green, please.
In the project presented, how have you tried to address that, knowing that vehicle miles of travel is the largest consumption of energy that we have today?
I'd like to.
Let me start with Miller. And believe me, this is one of the things that we are battling here. We are in Texas, and people do like to drive their automobiles, and these are big automobiles, long, long distances. But what has been hoped for Miller to achieve is to have the schools and the shops and the jobs very close to the neighborhood so that people will not have to drive to go to these activities. But there is also, you know, people drive to go to their gyms or to go to exercise. Well, there is a whole another part. They have amenities center. They have several neighborhood pools, some of them as big as junior Olympic size pools. So it's something, it's a development that hopes to keep the people in there and spend their time mostly there. The other part is that the transportation is going to be really exceptional. It's something that we don't have in Austin right now, but both the light commuter rail and the streetcars are going to connect the neighborhood well with the surrounding neighborhoods and with the major areas within Austin, the downtown and UT, where most people seem to be working. But we haven't come up with a study that I know of that will estimate what the mileage is going to be. And we are evaluating every project that is built there. It has some type of parking. We are trying to see, is this enough? Is this utilized so far? Or if it is underutilized, then we need to make sure that from the next project, we don't build additional garages for people to drive there.
Somebody's had their hand up.
Doug. I think this also goes to that point I was saying in the very beginning of my little session, which is don't underestimate the value of stating the obvious to your clients. Most of us in this audience know the value of reduced vehicle miles traveled. I had that one slide up. I didn't talk about it much, but we all talk about it. We all know that we're all driving too much. But you understand how much the public gets bombarded with the thinking from the other side of the fence. The builder's parade of homes, the new subdivisions, the gated communities, if that's not an oxymoron, I don't know what is, but the gated communities out off the highways in the suburbs. So what they see in the newspapers is being bombarded with this automobile-dominated idea of planning. And all I can say is our job, all of us at this conference, is to make sure we talk to all of our friends who will hear us, all the groups that will hear us about the smarter way of developing so you can live life without the automobile. You got to articulate the values to these people.
Two more questions. You've had your hand up.
Minimum energy efficient standards that needed to happen before the closing of the home.
Well, the mayor, a couple of days ago, I think, spoke about the climate protection plan that we are putting forth. And this is a very ambitious plan. And some of the things, one of the things that is within the plan is to make sure that every home, when it is sold, it reaches the code levels at that time. Actually, codes in Austin are changing rapidly. Peter was involved in a task force last year that is trying to make sure that by 2015, all homes, all new homes built in Austin will be zero energy capable. That means that the design of the home will do so much so that the small amount of energy that will still be needed for the home to function will be cost effective to supply it through renewable sources and primarily probably photovoltaics. Now, this plan that you're talking about is about the older homes and how we're going to bring those back up to code and in some cases very challenging codes. The homes that are built in Austin, in Miller, they are all energy efficient homes, not up to zero energy standards, although some of them are already very close to that. But yes, the Austin Energy Green Building has very specific points and initiatives and minimum requirements for the energy that is used by the homes.
I think we should come up with a standard for a zero VMT capable home to put in place by 2015. Last question. Who has an urbanist question? Okay, you with the waving hand. Ooh, that's a double hit.
Well, you can do solar shading on an eight-story building as well as a two-story building. It benefits you tremendously to have awnings or some type of mid-level overhangs above each and every window. And let me just make a little point about that, too. I think this is obvious, too, but, you know, if you keep the sun off a building, it doesn't need to be painted as often. And if you keep the rain off a building or the windows, they don't have to be cleaned as often. So you actually do reduce a lot of work by just shielding the building from itself or from the elements. But, yeah, we've done multi-story buildings with awnings above each and every one or balconies at each and every unit so that the balcony of the upper unit shaded the balcony and the windows of the lower unit. Simple things like that. The glass box is probably the last thing in the world you want to do.
I don't think there's a lot of demand for that in this conference, so we're pretty safe there. I want to say the last sentence before I thank our presenters. You know, I'm struck by the interaction of urbanism and green building and how strongly I am convinced that the urbanism has to be right before the green buildings should start appearing. And so, you know, having the urbanism wrong and still building green buildings is... I'm sure half the audience is wincing at some of the projects. So we need to increase the opportunities for dialogue and an intelligent, high-level discussion like this. We couldn't have had it without three excellent presenters. AICP, if you're interested in AICP credits, apparently that gets emailed to you, so there are no forms. So for that question, thank our panelists. Thank you for coming.
Cigarettes.
Sorry, yeah. But your cover there.
What is the time frame for Master Transit?
Hey, Sam. How we doing?
What about bus lines?
Thanks for working.
I really appreciate your presentation.
I'm sorry, Herb, but it's because I'm writing a book and my publisher asked me to